This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents The Redemption of Time, a Three-Body Problem Novel by Bao Shu, translated by Ken Liu, narrated for you by P.J. Oakland. This book is dedicated to Mr. Liu Zixin. Preface to the English edition. Writing The Redemption of Time is one of the most remarkable events of my life. Like many others, I became a loyal fan of Liu Zixin at the beginning of the 21st century, when Liu was just starting to make his mark as a science fiction author. We called ourselves Zetie, meaning magnets, which is a pun for the Chinese abbreviation of diehard fans of Liu Zixin, and passionately discussed his stories on internet forums. As each of his stories was published, the news spread among us like wildfire, and we rushed out to buy the magazine issue. In 2006, when Science Fiction World serialized The Three-Body Problem, the first book in his magnificent Remembrance of Earth's Past trilogy, also known as the Three-Body Trilogy, I devoured each installment and hungered for the next, utterly entranced. The standalone edition of The Three-Body Problem was published at the beginning of 2008, and the first sequel, The Dark Forest, came out about 6 months later. Although the books hadn't yet penetrated mainstream literary conversation, science fiction fans enjoyed the rich imaginative feast presented by these two books. However, after those first two books, I and the other Zetie had to resign ourselves to a long wait for the next installment. 2.5 years later, in November of 2010, the last volume of the trilogy, Death's End, finally went on sale in China. At the time, I was in graduate school in Belgium and could not get my hands on the book. I seriously considered flying back to China just to buy it. In the end, my friend Gao Xiang helped me out by photographing every page of the book and emailing the pictures to me. I was deeply touched by my friend's gesture, but it wasn't until much later that I understood the full significance of the publication of this novel for me. After I finished Death's End, along with fans in China who had bought the book as soon as it came out, we debated and explored every detail in the book over the internet. But no matter how many posts we wrote, the magnificent grand arc of the trilogy was at an end, and we felt ourselves drifting away from the story day by day. The melancholy that seized us made me decide to write separate stories for a few of the characters in the trilogy and extend the epic tale a little longer. 2 days later, I wrote down a dialogue between Yun Tianming and IAA on Planet Blue and posted it on the web under the title Three Body X. X didn't mean 10. Rather, it stood for uncertain. This wasn't the first time I wrote Liu Zixin fan fiction, and I certainly wasn't the first to do so. But before my tale, most such efforts were written by fans for a small group of other hardcore fans. I had no idea that the context for Three Body X was entirely different. What I wrote was exactly what tens of thousands of readers needed at that moment. More stories from the three-body universe. Its timely appearance, barely a week after the publication of Death's End, allowed it to receive far more attention than could be justified by its inherent quality, and the praise encouraged me to continue writing, developing, and growing the storyline I had in mind until it gradually took on a shape of its own. 3 weeks later, before Christmas 2010, I completed my novel. By then, Three Body X had spread to every corner of the Chinese web and received almost as much discussion and attention as Death's End itself. Mr. Yao Haijun, Liu Zixin's good friend, who is nicknamed the Chinese Campbell for his role in developing new writers as the executive editor of Science Fiction World, contacted me to ask if he could publish it as a standalone book. A few months later, as three-body fever continued to sweep Chinese SF fandom, more fan fiction appeared. But the brief window of opportunity was gone, and these new works did not receive nearly as much attention as mine. I knew that I was lucky. When I first posted my story online, I wasn't thinking much about copyright. Of course, once a formal offer of publication came from Mr. Yao, I was faced with a complicated set of issues. But Liu Zexin displayed incredible generosity and kindness toward new writers by giving me permission to publish, and I cannot express the full extent of my deep gratitude. As soon as the book came off the presses, I sent a copy to Liu Zexin. A few years later, after I'd published some original stories and become a regular member of the small circle of Chinese science fiction writers, Liu and I became friends and often met at fandom events. He told me that he enjoyed Three Body X, and indeed had even voted for it at Chinese Science Fiction Awards. The book didn't win, but Liu's encouragement and approval were better than winning 10 such awards. The subtitle for the prequel, The Redemption of Time, and some other names in the novel have special meanings for fans, though few now probably remember the sources of the allusions. Between 2008 and 2010, while fans impatiently waited for the arrival of the last volume of the trilogy, many speculated on potential directions the plot could take and spread various rumors centered around supposed leaks from Liu Zexin's draft in progress. Of course, all of these rumors turned out to be hoaxes, and not a single one matched the published book. But even such rumors brought eager fans some joy in imagining the conclusion of Liu Zexin's masterpiece, and so I referenced some keywords from those rumors as a memorial to that innocent time when Three Body was still a relatively obscure playground known to only the most dedicated fans. To be sure, my prequel did not receive and could not have received the sort of plaudits that accompany the Three Body series proper, but it was also true that many readers enjoyed it greatly. I certainly make no claim that Three Body X constitutes a part of the Three Body canon, though it was published by the same publisher as the original trilogy and sold together with Liu Zexin's books. I view it as a dedicated fan's attempt to explain and fill out some of the gaps in the original trilogy, one of countless possible developments of the three-body universe. Any fans of the trilogy proper could reject it as incompatible with their vision, or could enjoy it without treating it as part of the universe. I think these are all perfectly reasonable responses. 4 years after the publication of Three Body X, China Educational Publications Import and Export Corporation Limited decided to introduce this book to Anglophone readers after the publication of the English edition of the Three Body Trilogy. I feel both anxiety and trepidation at this prospect. There certainly have been some notable works of fan fiction in the history of English science fiction, such as the Second Foundation trilogy by Gregory Benford, Greg Bear, and David Brin, as well as Stephen Baxter's epic The Time Ships, a continuation of H.G. Wells's The Time Machine. And I haven't even mentioned shared universes like Doctor Who and Star Trek, which have provided fertile ground for the creativity of many other authors. I don't pretend to claim that my novel is the equal of these successful classics, but there is something that unites all of them. Great works of uncommon genius will call for us to return to their worlds again and again, enticing us to pour our passion and enthusiasm into them, so that time may continue to cycle and progress, beloved characters may return to life, and the universes may continue to evolve and develop without cease. Bao Shu, August 30, 2015. Calendar Eras. Crisis Era. Sometime in the decade of 2010 to 2208. Deterrence Era. 2208 to 2270. Post-Deterrence Era. 2270 to 2272. Broadcast Era. 2272 to 2332. Bunker Era. 2333 to 2400. Galaxy Era. 2273 to unknown. Planet Blue Era. 2687 to 2731. Timeline for preparation of Universe 647. 2731 to 18,906,416. Timeline for Universe 647. 18,906,416 to 11,245,632,151. Terminal Era. 11,245,632,142 to 11,245,632,207. New Universe Timeline. 11,245,632,207 to Prologue. Terminal Era. Year 1. 0 hours, 0 minutes, 0 seconds. The end of the universe. A long, long time ago, in another galaxy, the stars still shone brightly. The galaxy still swirled like a mighty river, and countless life forms still hid behind each sun, divided by the vastness of space. They concealed themselves in the nooks and crannies of the galaxy, growing, developing, struggling, slaughtering. The rhythms of life and the laments of death filled this obscure galaxy just as they filled every other part of the universe. However, this ancient and far-flung universe was nearing the end of its own life. In a sphere with a radius of 10 billion light years, stars were dying at an unimaginable rate, one by one. Civilizations winked out, galaxies dimmed, and all were returning to the void, as though they had never existed. The countless lives in this galaxy did not know yet that all their struggles and setbacks, their concealments and slaughters, had lost meaning. Against the greater background of the universe as a whole, a terrifying, unanticipated change was about to take place. Their very existence was about to be reduced to nothingness. Faint photons from already dead galaxies billions of light years away had traversed the endless darkness of space to illuminate this out-of-the-way galaxy, like letters without recipients, silently recounting bygone legends of the vanished. One of these beams had originated in a little-noticed nook of the universe, once known as the Milky Way. It was so faint that the eyes of the vast majority of living beings could not detect it. Yet it contained innumerable legends that had once moved heaven and earth, shocked belief and understanding. Ye Wenjie, Mike Evans, Ding Yi, Frederick Tyler, Zhang Beihai, Bill Hines, Luo Ji, Thomas Wade. Red Coast Base, the Earth Tri-Solaris Organization, the Wallfacer Project, the Staircase Program, the Swordholders, the Bunker Project. The ancient stories remained as vivid as though they had taken place yesterday. The figures of heroes and saints continued to twinkle among the constellations. But knowledge of the tales had faded, and there was no one left to mark their passing. The curtain had fallen, and the players had departed from the stage. The audience had scattered to the winds. Even the theater had long since fallen into ruin. Until, in the endless darkness of space, in a forgotten corner a long way from any star, a ghost appeared out of the void. Faint gleams of starlight limned a shape vaguely resembling a creature that had once been known as a human. The ghost knew that for billions of light years around this spot, there were no other beings who would have recognized a human shape. Its world and species had long ago disappeared, leaving no trace behind. That species, which had once created a civilization that had lit up a galaxy, conquered billions of worlds, destroyed countless foes, and enacted magnificent epics, had submerged in the river of history, which had in turn melded with the ocean that was time. Now, even the ocean of time was about to dry up. But at the end of the universe, at the moment when time was about to cease its flow, This ghost stubbornly wished to continue writing a story that was already concluded. Floating in darkness, the ghost extended a limb, let's call it an arm, and spread out five fingers. A tiny silvery spot of light hung in the palm. The eyes of the ghost reflected the countless stars as it stared at the silvery dot, as though lost in reminiscence. The bright spot of light drifted up and down like a delicate firefly, so small that it could wink out at any moment, but also, like the singularity before the birth of the universe, embodying all possibilities. The bright dot was a minuscule wormhole connected to the great black hole at the heart of a galaxy, capable of releasing a galaxy's worth of energy. After some time, no one knew how long, as there was no one around who cared to measure the passage of time, the ghost issued its order. The bright dot dissolved into a silvery thread extending into the distance like an infinite timeline. In another moment, the thread unrolled into a white plane. A third dimension appeared as the plane undulated and gained thickness, but the thickness was insignificant compared with the width and breadth. The ghost had unfurled a giant sheet of blank drawing paper and now floated above it. The ghost spread its arms and glided. A light breeze followed its movements, and an atmosphere materialized out of nowhere. Beneath it, the sheet of paper seemed to react to the breeze, forming wrinkles and waves. The peaks and valleys soon solidified into mountains, hills, canyons, and plains. Then came fire and water. As massive explosions erupted everywhere, oxygen and hydrogen, formed out of pure energy, combined into bright flames that coalesced into a sea of fire. New water molecules generated by the reaction fused into droplets, merged into clouds and mists, and then consolidated into torrential rain that fell against the newborn Earth. The endless rain flooded the plains, converting them into vast oceans. The ghost swept over the waters like a gigantic bird and landed on an empty beach. Stretching out its arms, one toward the waves and one toward the hills, it lifted both at once. Brontobytes of data stored inside its body came to life, and absorbing energy from the surroundings, took form. Life appeared in water and on land, as though deposited there by a cyclone. Shoals of fish and pods of whales leapt out of the tides to honor their creator. Patches of grass and stands of trees erupted from the soil, with beasts and creeping things wandering among them. Flocks of birds, large and small, swept across the sky. The noise and bustle of life filled this new world, and as living things materialized, so did forests, grasslands, lakes, and deserts. Having completed these tasks, the ghost still felt that the world lacked something important. It gazed thoughtfully into the dark sky until it realized what was missing. With a single finger, it described a circle against the dark velvet Empyrean. Then, pulling the hand back, it flicked that finger, and a bright dot shot into the circle in the sky, turning it into a fiery golden orb. The familiar sun had reappeared, or so it seemed. As sunlight refracted through the atmosphere, the whole world lit up. Azure sky, clear and smooth as a mirror. Cerulean sea, sparkling and shimmering. The ghost bathed in the new light, which had long been absent from its existence. Intoxicated, it gently lifted its head.
"This is just like that golden age, long ago."
Sunshine gleamed against his skin and hair, filling in the outline of a typical human. It was obvious now, or would have been if anyone had been around to observe it, that the ghost was no mere spirit, but a person, a he, a man from that long-ago world once known as Earth. And this new world, just like the mythical Earth, beckoned to him with a sense of familiarity. It was a shadow cast at the end of the universe by that ancient planet, long after it had been destroyed along with the innumerable human civilizations that had once inhabited it. The ghost knew that, compared with the grand universe that had once existed, compared with even just the real Earth, this artificial world was tiny, inauthentic, and insignificant. He had created it anyway, so that the cosmic epic that had already concluded could go on just a bit longer. Even if his addition would not be a true continuation, wasn't it a joy to be immersed in this virtual world for a few more moments and to experience the dying embers of that imitation sun as the universe irresistibly wound down?
"Sunset for the universe,"
he muttered. Part 1. The Past Within Time. Planet Blue Era. Year 2. Our Star. Our World. The sky was a misty, dark gray. A familiar afternoon drizzle enveloped the lake in a gentle mist. The grass at the shore dipped and swayed in the breeze, thirstily drinking the sweet raindrops. A toy boat woven from blades of grass drifted over the water, riding farther and farther from the bank on ripples spawned by the rain.
"As though it's heading for the world's end."
Yun Tianming sat on the shore and aimlessly tossed pebbles into the lake, watching the ripples crisscross each other. A woman sat next to him, gazing at him without speaking. The breeze lifted strands of her long hair to brush against his cheeks, the caress arousing his desire. For a moment, Tianming experienced the illusion of being in another time and another place, as though he had returned to that college outing in the suburbs of Beijing with his classmates, returned to that happy afternoon he had spent by the side of Cheng Xin. But the lemon-colored water, the blue grass, and the vera-colored pebbles around him reminded him that this was a different era in a different world, a planet 300 light-years away, and almost 7 centuries later. And a different woman.
"Slanting rain, gentle breeze, no need to return home."
Tianming didn't know why he'd thought of a line of classical Chinese poetry, something that his parents, who had admired classical education so much, had forced him to memorize. He could no longer imagine going home. There was no home to return to. He could only endure the cold wind and rain on this alien planet.
"What a fool," Tianming castigated himself. "Did I really think I was going to get another chance with Cheng Xin, my beloved, and make toy boats by a lake? Wake up."
The very idea that he might reunite with the woman of his dreams 7 centuries later was absurd. The fact that he was now sitting next to a female of the same species was already an incredible miracle. But a greater miracle had once been within his grasp. After being apart for 700 years, he could have seen that woman if only he had gotten here a few hours, even a few minutes earlier. He could have spent the rest of his life with the woman he had been in love with for 7 centuries on the shore of this lake, never again parting from her. The woman who sat next to him now, on the other hand, would have been only his wife's best friend and married to another man. Even now, Cheng Xin was not so far from him, at most only a few 100 kilometers away. On clear nights, he could even see her spaceship orbiting this planet slowly. However, though he could admire her from afar, she was forever out of his reach. He had once given her a star, but now, because of the sudden expansion of the death line, she would never be able to land on this world. She had become his star. Tianming grimaced and glanced at the sky out of habit. Today, because of the rain and clouds, he could see nothing. but he knew that she was there, above the clouds, perhaps even drifting overhead at that moment. Tianming pulled his gaze back and realized that her eyes were still staring at him. He pretended not to notice. A pair of arms, like vines, entwined around his neck. He was readying himself to enjoy this moment of intimacy when the arm's owner spoke, asking a question that lovers across eons and galaxies and species and sexes had all asked.
"Hey, who do you like more? Me or her?"
"You, of course."
"But in what way?"
IAA refused to give up.
"You have to be specific. I thought Changxin..."
But her question was interrupted by a kiss. Numerous similar experiences had taught Tianming the painful lesson that there was no appropriate answer under such circumstances, nor was there any need to speak. IAA gave in to the kiss, and once the kiss had ended, she did not pursue the previous line of questioning. Shyly, she bit Tianming's earlobe. A moment later, as though unsatisfied, she bit his shoulder. Hard. Tianming screamed and pushed her away. Hallucinations that had long been buried in his memory erupted forth, weighing down his consciousness. He had trouble breathing and could not think. He pressed his head between his hands in pain.
"I was just playing."
Although IAA's immediate reaction was that he was being dramatic, when she saw the pallor in his face and the tremors that racked his body, she realized that he was terrified, perhaps delirious. She had seen him going through such episodes from time to time.
"Tianming, what's wrong?"
she asked with concern. Tianming stared back at her, confused and frightened, panting heavily. After a long pause, he asked,
Are you real?"
"What are you talking about?"
Now AA was frightened. She approached him, arms open for an embrace, but Tianming backed away and gazed at her suspiciously, his body crouched defensively. He repeated his question.
"Are you a real person, or just a hallucination? Is this whole world a trick in my mind?"
AA grasped the seriousness of the situation. Taking a deep breath, she spoke slowly.
"I am real. Tianming, look at me. I'm standing right here in front of you. Every inch of my skin, every hair on my head, they're all real. The planet we're on is absolutely real. This is our world."
"Our world?"
Tianming asked.
"Yes. Do you remember that day when we stood here waiting for Changxin and Guan Yifan? We watched as their spaceship entered orbit around Planet Blue. You laughed like a child, holding my hand and telling me that you were going to surprise her, lead her into that marvelous little universe that even you had not seen. And then all of a sudden the death line expanded and the sky darkened. There was no more sun, no more stars. When you figured out what had happened, you just stood there like a zombie, not crying, not screaming. I didn't understand how much you loved her until I saw the depth of your despair."
"I do remember,"
Tianming muttered, but his expression remained far away.
"For 3 days and three nights, you didn't drink or eat and barely slept. I kept on telling you that they didn't die. They were just living in a different frame of reference, and maybe one day you would see each other again. But you didn't seem to hear me. Finally, on the third night, you cried. At first silently, and then weeping and sobbing, and finally howling and wailing. And I put my arms around you, and I heard you say to me, 'There are only the two of us on this planet, only the two of us.' Do you remember what I said to you next?"
"You said, 'You are my Adam, and I'm your Eve.'"
Tianming closed his eyes,
remembering.
I don't know how I found the words.
I.A.A. bit her lip and blushed.
Anyway, that was how you and I became a couple. We couldn't be free of the despair, of course. But on that day, at least, we let go and it was wonderful. The next day you told me, from now on, this is our world. Do you remember?
A smile appeared on Yun Tianming's face, perhaps without him even realizing it.
Yes, of course.
Then how can all of that be unreal?
A.A. asked. Smiling encouragingly, she took a step toward Tianming. This time he did not back away. She picked up his hands and wrapped his arms around herself as she hugged him, pressing her ear against his chest to listen to his heartbeat. Still confused, Tianming looked into the distance, allowing her to cling to him. Gently, she kissed his face. And gradually, hesitantly, Tianming returned her embrace. His gaze warmed and he returned her kiss, which she returned with even more ardor. Tianming received the most primitive and most authentic proof of the reality of the universe. The rain had stopped some time ago, and the blue grass swayed in the evening breeze. The light of dusk pierced the clouds and painted a golden edge on the azure hills. What happened next would have been unimaginable on Earth. The blue trees and shrubs of the forest came to life. They stretched as they woke, turning hundreds of thousands of leaves toward the warmth of the setting sun, absorbing every drop of energy. A few branches, fighting for more light, shoved and jostled against each other, filling the air with a susurrating noise. Dragonfly-like amphibious insects took off from the lake and danced in the air, spreading their four transparent wings to absorb the nutrients released by the blue grass and singing in high-pitched chirps to attract mates. Insects of the opposite sex responded with their own songs, and then pairs began the complicated mating dance above the lake, enacting the sacred ritual that allowed life to multiply and continue. All these sounds fused into one composition, Planet Blue's unique cantata of life. At the heart of this new black domain, life seemed to go on as before, except for the intrusion of two wanderers from afar. They clung to each other, and they would remain on this world forever. But to this planet that had already existed for billions of years and would continue to exist for billions more, the pair were nothing. They would disappear in a flash, leaving no trace behind, like the ripples passing over the surface of the lake. Gazing at the setting sun, Yun Tianming spoke softly.
I'd already thought of this world as a dream. A.A., forgive me for my behavior earlier. Even now, I still can't tell if I'm truly awake. I can no longer tell when a dream starts or when it ends. All of this seems to have no end.
No end? What do you mean?
Asked A.A.
How old are you now?
Tianming asked.
I can't remember. At least 400,
said A.A.
What if you don't count the years you were in hibernation?
I guess 20, 30 something? I really can't remember,
A.A. said.
By the standards of the Deterrence Era, you're still very young. But do you know how old I am?
A smidgen over 700, I'd say. But if you don't count the years of hibernation, I don't think you're much older than I am.
No.
As he spoke, Yun Tianming's eyes seemed ancient.
My mind is at least several thousand years old. Maybe even tens of thousands.
I.A.A. found this incomprehensible. But instead of asking more questions, she listened.
With a grimace, Tianming explained.
I know it's hard to believe. Here's the difference between the two of us. I spent the vast majority of my life in a dream. A dream that lasted tens of thousands of years. From the first year of the Crisis Era, from the moment my brain was frozen, I began to dream. Endless dreams filled my time as I drifted in the abyss of space. In retrospect, I'm sure much of that was false memory constructed later by my mind, since a brain kept near absolute zero could not possibly generate dreams. And then, once the Trisolarans captured me, they seized on dreams as their most potent weapon and employed them to stimulate me, to study me, to use me. Tianming kept his voice calm, as though describing a stroll by the lake. But Aie shivered. She knew, without needing Tianming to elaborate, that he had elided an unimaginable amount of suffering, pain, and terror. I, Aie, and Yun Tianming had been living together for a year on Planet Blue, since the day of the Deathline's expansion. A year on Planet Blue consists of about 400 days, and each day on Planet Blue is equal to about 2/3 of a day on Earth. All in all, a Planet Blue year is slightly shorter than an Earth year. They depended on each other and supported each other. And during this time, Tianming had suffered similar bouts of delirium multiple times. Tianming had never explained, and Aie had never pried, though she suspected that it had something to do with his experience among the Trisolarans. Aie understood that Tianming was the greatest spy in the history of the human race. Embodied in an isolated brain, he managed to infiltrate an alien species and gave humans invaluable intelligence. Knowing that such success could not have been achieved without paying a dear price, she could imagine the extent of the bloody, cruel tortures the Trisolarans inflicted on Tianming, and she yearned to understand the truth, to have Tianming share with her the weight of his past suffering and pain, to comfort him. But she dared not ask him, lest the questions rip the scabs off his wounds. Sometimes she even wondered whether the fragile bonds of love between them could truly heal the after effects of his painful ordeal. And so, today, as Tianming seemed finally ready to unburden himself, a bittersweet joy filled her heart. Just now, I couldn't help but remember those nightmares.
Tianming fidgeted with the pebbles at his feet.
In many of those Trisolaran manufactured dreams, I was back at that college outing, sitting next to Cheng Xin, conversing intimately. Then she would pull me to her, kiss me, engulf me in indescribable sweetness and happiness. And then, abruptly, she would turn into a terrible monster. Her skin covered in scales, her red lips revealing sharp fangs, and she would lock her jaws around my throat and drag me into the bottomless lake, there to drown in frigid terror.
How horrible!
Aie cried out.
Horrible!
Tianming let out a laugh that sounded more like a sob.
I haven't even gotten to the truly horrible parts. Many have suffered nightmares far worse than this. But what distinguished my dreams was their level of detail. I can still vividly recall the sharp teeth that penetrated my body and the soulless compound eyes that stared into mine. The sensations of agony and suffocation are indistinguishable from reality. That's not all. My nightmares never ended. I couldn't breathe in the lake. But I didn't wake up, nor did I black out, and I certainly couldn't die. Time stopped, and the pain went on and on. My consciousness flickered in and out of focus. One moment I understood it was a hallucination. but the next I had forgotten. Struggling helplessly, as the monster continued to devour me.
Tian Ming's voice grew faint, as though he were talking in his sleep.
In those moments, I held on to the memory of one person. Like Dante's Beatrice, she appeared in the clouds, surrounded by angels, a crown woven from flowers on her head, flames wrapped about her body like a dress. That holy light pierced the dark water of the lake, giving me a ray of hope. I told myself, Cheng Xin is not a monster. She is a goddess who will bring me salvation. I won't be deceived. This is just the devil playing tricks on me. But the world isn't governed by fairy tales. Just because I called out to my goddess didn't mean that she would come to save me. Thinking of Cheng Xin and holding on to that slender thread of hope did not bring me relief. Instead, it ripped my heart apart.
Stop,
AA said, caressing his stubbly cheeks lovingly.
I understand. Forget about those nightmares. They were only dreams and long in the past.
No, you don't understand anything at all.
Tian Ming pushed her hand away and stood up, agitated. These weren't dreams at all. Don't you get it? The Trisolaran stimulated my neurons with electrical signals. For me, these signals were reality. As real as seeing you, touching you now. There's no difference at the level of neural activity. They injected those nightmares into my brain and made them real by taking advantage of biological mechanisms to which I had no defense. I wasn't fighting illusions with reality. Instead, I was making illusions to fight reality. A battle that I couldn't win. What use was it for me to conjure Cheng Xin? In response to my pleas, my tormentors could make her show up in my mind, giving me hope that a miracle had occurred, that salvation was at hand. But then they would turn the visitation into an even worse hell, one 1,000 times worse than the one I had just suffered. In one dream, I lived together with Cheng Xin for 10 years, and we even had a wonderful little daughter. But those 10 years of joy and tranquility were but a prelude for the inferno to follow. A great famine struck the land, and all of us were so emaciated, we were barely more than skin and bones, close to dying. Yet one day, somehow Cheng Xin made a pot of meat stew for me. I was baffled. Where did we get the meat? After eating some, I discovered a clump of hair and a patch of skin in a corner of the kitchen. I was shocked. Cheng Xin then lifted something out of the pot for me with a ladle. It was round and fleshy, boiled for so long that it was almost falling apart. I recognized it as the head of my daughter. Smiling, Cheng Xin said to me, "Delicious, isn't it? Have some more."
Ha!
AA grabbed Tian Ming's arm, utterly nauseated. She could not imagine living through such a nightmare. But Tian Ming continued to explain, almost cruelly.
The worst part was that even though I wanted to throw up, and I was racked with grief and terror, my hunger seemed to have a mind of its own. I couldn't help it. Mouthful by mouthful, I ate my daughter, until I was so full that I burped. Once satiated, Cheng Xin and I even made love next to my daughter's bones before falling asleep. When I woke up, I found myself tightly bound and unable to move. Cheng Xin knelt down next to me and explained that she had to eat me to survive. As I watched in horror, she bit into my arm, tore off a piece of flesh with her teeth, chewed and swallowed.
she continued until all the flesh had been picked off the bones.
AA could not stand it anymore.
Stop, stop it, I beg you.
She turned around and retched, and her mouth filled with the foul taste of acid. When she had recovered, she asked,
But why? Why did the Trisolarans torture you with such grotesque visions?
To understand humanity,
Tianming answered.
If you think about it, it's not strange at all. Although the Sofans helped them keep everything happening on Earth under surveillance, they couldn't understand our emotional responses or physical reactions without experimentation. The nightmare I just described to you wouldn't have struck the Trisolarans as a tragedy, since they operated according to a moral code completely alien to us. They often consumed the flesh of other dehydrated Trisolarans, and so they were baffled by the human revulsion against cannibalism. I can tell you stories that are far more disgusting. For example,
Why don't we save such unpleasant stories for another time?
AA interrupted. She finally understood why Tianming never mentioned his experiences among the Trisolarans.
No matter what, Tianming, you have to remember this. You survived those trials and won their trust and respect. You inserted yourself into the heart of an alien society. Your sacrifices were worth it.
Tianming looked at her, grimacing.
Yes, of course my sacrifices were worth it. They brought about the destruction of Earth and the human race.
AA stared at Tianming in confusion. Taking a deep breath, he finally revealed to her the secret he had always kept from everyone.
Don't you understand, AA? The only reason that I could win the trust of the Trisolarans and infiltrate their society was because I surrendered. The droplet attack that ended the Deterrence Era was, in large measure, my work.
If one were to pick a single individual to bear the responsibility for the destruction of humanity's cradle, the most appropriate choice would not be Cheng Xin, Yun Tianming, or anyone else whose decisions swayed the lives of billions. It would have to be Thomas Wade, who had dedicated himself to the task of saving the human race through a program of violent struggle. More than 600 years ago, he had uttered the fateful words that determined the ultimate fate of two species. We'll send only a brain. This stroke of genius propelled the staircase program out of its darkest moments and handed the Trisolarans a precious human brain specimen. Although the Sofans were capable of observing the human brain in minute detail, such passive observation was insufficient to gain an in-depth understanding of the mechanisms of human cognition. Moreover, after Wallfacer Bill Hines's efforts at mental sabotage, humanity's leaders grew increasingly concerned with the dangers of neuroscience research. Researchers were forbidden to delve into the specifics of how bioelectric signals between neurons gave rise to thought, lest such research give the Trisolarans the capability to read human thoughts through detailed neuroelectric monitoring. 2 centuries after initial contact, human cognition still presented an impenetrable black box to the Trisolarans. The aliens desperately wanted to experiment on a live human. Their enthusiasm wasn't driven entirely by scientific curiosity. Rather, it was out of a desperate, practical need for strategic deception. Throughout the Crisis Era, the Trisolarans saw no need for practicing strategic deception against humans, just as humans needed only pesticides, not lies, to take care of troublesome bugs. However, that didn't mean the Trisolarans were unaware of the value of such deception against other targets. Ever since they had discovered the dark forest state of the cosmos, the Trisolarans had lived in a state of perpetual terror of the rest of the universe. They knew that countless hunters were concealed in the galaxy, and the previous communications between Trisolaris and Earth were likely to be discovered and posed a threat for their own survival. Strategic deception was an important defensive weapon they had to consider. But to wield it, the Trisolarans first had to understand the only species known to possess such a capability. Humans. A branch of advanced knowledge known as deceptionology arose among the Trisolaran elite soon after Evans revealed this unique feature of human cognition. The Trisolarans at first hoped to learn this human skill quickly, but that hope was soon dashed. Theoretically, understanding the principles of deception posed little difficulty. One simply had to purposefully make a false statement, which would achieve the desired goal when the target of deception believed it. Unfortunately, the Trisolaran scientists soon realized that their species lacked the biological instinct for lying, and they could not put this simple principle into operation. It wasn't very different from how human scientists could describe the mathematical underpinnings for four-dimensional space in detail, but could not construct even very simple four-dimensional figures in their minds. Like all sentient beings, the Trisolarans occasionally made mistakes, but as their language consisted of the electrical patterns of thought being emitted directly, there was no way for them to speak of a known falsehood while pretending it was true. If a Trisolaran believed that a statement was false, the cognitive markers were immediately exhibited externally. Although in certain special situations, such as technology-enabled long-distance communication, it was possible to manufacture the signals of false brain activity, the deep biological instinct of the Trisolarans, inherited from their long evolutionary march up from primitive life forms, prevented them from taking such a step. The Trisolarans had hoped that they could gain the ability to practice the art of deception by studying human history, including advanced works in politics, military strategy, commerce, and game theory. But they soon discovered that they could not understand human history, nor could they decipher theoretical tomes on these subjects by human authors. To be sure, few humans understood those works either. They turned to works of fiction, which seemed easier to understand. For some time, various popular tales of deception were required reading for Trisolaran scientists and politicians. Books like The Count of Monte Cristo, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, and Romance of the Three Kingdoms became bestsellers. But the aliens didn't have the capacity to appreciate these books either. Novels that humans consumed for entertainment and leisure appeared to the Trisolarans as abstruse, incomprehensible treatises. Even after years of study, the most intelligent Trisolaran strategists could understand only the simple deceptions presented in fairy tales like Little Red Riding Hood. Such techniques were, of course, useless for devising grand strategies applicable to interstellar warfare. After decades of fruitless effort, the Trisolarans had to give up the ambitious plan to fundamentally change their own nature. They redirected their efforts to devising computer simulations to generate potential strategic deception scenarios. However, computers were capable of nothing more than reproducing and extending the abilities of their creators. In order to endow computers with special skills, it was necessary to write the requisite software. And to write such software, it was necessary to understand the relevant principles in depth. If human beings were not capable of coming up with a proof for Goldbach conjecture, they could hardly expect computers produced by humans to calculate such a proof. Similarly, since the Trisolarans did not understand deception, neither did their computers. Finally, after years of concentrated development and repeated trials by generations of the best Trisolaran minds, aided by access to data equivalent to the storage capacity of all human libraries, the most advanced Trisolaran computers attain the ability to practice deception at the level of the average 12-year-old human, although such performance was only possible in environments familiar to humans, since all scenarios used to train the computers were derived from such environments. Such skills were of limited applicability to potential conflicts between the Trisolaran civilization and other undiscovered alien civilizations. In many cases, computers running deception software could not even carry out a sensible conversation, failing the basic Turing test. After having wasted so many years on a wild goose chase, Trisolaran scientists concluded that in order to acquire the capacity for strategic deception, it was vital to study an actual human specimen. Before the Trisolaran fleet reached the Earth and conquered it, the only available human specimen was Yun Tianming's brain, which had already left the solar system. At the end of the Crisis Era, the Trisolaran fleet diverted a ship for the sole purpose of intercepting the probe carrying the brain of Yun Tianming. Humanity then mistakenly interpreted the departure of this ship as an attempt by the Trisolarans to seek peace in the face of overwhelming human strength, and this misinterpretation then indirectly led to the destruction of the human fleet at the Doomsday Battle. In that sense, this act of unintended strategic deception by the Trisolarans was rather successful. The Trisolaran fleet succeeded in capturing the probe with Yun Tianming's brain only after Luo Ji had established strategic deterrence. By then, Earth and Trisolaris were locked in a delicate balance of power. After years of being blocked by the Sofons, Earth's technological development took off by leaps and bounds. Trisolaris, on the other hand, saw its advantage slip day by day. The primary target for Trisolaran strategic deception was no longer some unknown alien species in the future, but humanity. Although there were still some spiritual successors of the ETO on Earth willing to plot and scheme for the aliens, the Trisolarans were unwilling to engage in any trickery right under the eyes of humans and risk triggering a universal broadcast. Probing and understanding Yun Tianming thus took on an unprecedented importance. It took the Trisolarans about 10 Earth years to figure out the basic structure of Yun Tianming's brain. Taking into account Trisolaran efficiency, which far exceeded that of humans, their progress was equivalent to a century's worth of work by humans. They constructed a simulated body for the captured brain so that it could experience sight, sound, touch, taste, smell, and then they studied it to understand how sensory signals were generated and transmitted. Next, the aliens tried to interpret the information contained in Tianming's memories. To accomplish this feat, the Trisolarans stimulated the language center of Tianming's brain at the appropriate times, so that he would tell them what he was seeing, what he was hearing, what he was thinking, and so on. Although they still couldn't read his thoughts directly, by means of trial and error with different stimuli, they learned to inject any information they wished into his brain, and then observed his responses through his narration. At first, the Trisolarans were very careful with their test subject, and the experiments were gentle and mild. Indeed, they fed Tianming many beautiful sights and comforting scenes. These experiments left illusory memories in Tianming's mind of dreaming during his long flight through the darkness of space. But as the Trisolarans mastered the details of Tianming's brain, their experiments grew crueler and more violent. Many times they pushed Tianming to the precipice of mental breakdown, but they knew enough to stop just at the edge and to calm him with tranquilizing chemicals, giving Tianming a chance to recover. Although they learned to read Tianming's thoughts with relative precision, the Trisolarans discovered that due to the unique neural topology of each individual, what they learned from him was applicable to other humans only at a very basic level. The neural structures and patterns for higher thought they learned belonged to Tianming alone. The Trisolaran dream of reading all human thought remained out of reach. The individuality of experience and memory thus preserved the black box nature of human thought. If the Trisolarans had had access to thousands or millions of test subjects, they probably could have broken through this barrier as well. Alas, the Trisolarans had only Yun Tianming. Still, what they accomplished with just one brain was immense. With 7 Earth years of additional concentrated study of Tianming's brain, the Trisolarans completed the first digital model of the organ. This model contained all the information in his mind at the quantum level and could be used to simulate his basic thoughts. After the Trisolarans deleted all the useless human sentiments and sense of belonging from this digital brain, they filled it with their own data, hoping that the machine mind could then help the Trisolarans with devising plots and schemes. The Trisolarans called this invention cloud computing, because it concealed the light of truth like a cloud, and because Yun in Chinese meant cloud. As Trisolaran civilization grew increasingly commercialized, low-cost versions of Yun Tianming's simulated digital brain found applications as consumer technology. The Trisolarans installed these cloud computing devices on their organs of cognition and relied on them to disguise their own true thoughts, thereby achieving novel effects impossible for the unenhanced Trisolaran. For example, a traditional conversation during the Trisolaran mating season might go something like this. My dear Sex 1 entity, this humble Sex 2 entity wishes to join our bodies. The imploring Trisolaran would wave its feelers in a gesture of desire. Like humans, the Trisolarans are also divided into two sexes, though they are entirely different from human sexes. Get away from me, you ugly thing! The very sight of you makes me wish to expel fecal matter. The other Trisolaran would release thought waves that indicated extreme disgust. Such honesty from the second Trisolaran often led to fierce fights between the two parties, an unfortunate state of affairs no one desired. The invention of cloud computing allowed uninterested Trisolarans to answer in a more indirect manner. Thank you. I think you're wonderful, but I don't think I'm good enough for you. The imploring Trisolaran would then leave, satisfied and proud, perhaps even happier than if it had made it. This was without a doubt a major improvement in Trisolaran society, but some other applications of the technology did not seem so wonderful. Due to the lack of deception and the almost eidetic memory of Trisolarans, there was no cash or coinage on Trisolaris. Most business transactions were not even recorded, but involved only the recitation of desired prices and remaining balances. A typical Trisolaran market exchange, described as follows, was practically unimaginable for humans. I'd like to purchase this rapid-action dehydrator. I still have 12,563 credits. I'll now pay you 231 credits, leaving me with 12,332 credits. Agreed. I had 73,212 credits. I've just received 231 credits, giving me a total of 73,443 credits. Done. I'll now take the rapid action dehydrator and leave. In reality, market exchanges didn't involve such ponderous dialogue. The two parties simply projected their separate calculations and observed the changes in the counterparty. If one side made a mistake, the other side would immediately correct it. But cloud computing allowed a Trisolaran to disguise true thought waves and project falsified results. A poor Trisolaran without the funds for luxuries could claim to be a billionaire, and no matter what they bought, their account balances never decreased. Merchants could similarly claim that the basest goods were really special, high-quality specimens and jack up the prices. The popularity of cloud computing almost led to the total collapse of the Trisolaran economy. The Trisolaran government had to ban the direct installation of cloud computing devices on organs of cognition, on penalty of immediate dehydration followed by incineration. To enforce the ban, cloud detectors were installed in various locations. Finally, market order was restored. But even if cloud computing devices could not be integrated directly with Trisolaran thinking, it was fun for the average Trisolaran to converse with an imitation Yun Tianming brain. If one controlled for the relative slowness of human thought and the pronounced forgetfulness, a human was not unintelligent compared with a Trisolaran. In fact, the human mind possessed some qualities that were unmatched by the Trisolaran mind. Other than being deceptive, a human was also sensitive to nature, curious, imaginative, and creative, unpredictably so. In some sense, mastering human thinking processes, specifically Yun Tianming's mind, was the key to the Tricelerin technology explosion at the end of the Deterrence Era, culminating in the invention of curvature propulsion. This was the real reason for the high honor and genuine gratitude the Tricelerins accorded Yun Tianming. Later, after he demonstrated loyalty to Tricelaris, they granted him a very elevated social status. Cloud computing nonetheless proved inadequate for directly advancing the strategic goals of the Tricelerins. The second generation simulated Yun Tianming brains used digital models specifying quantum-level details. But just as Hines had discovered during the Common Era, human thought was affected by quantum uncertainty. The Tricelerins couldn't replicate the activities in Yun Tianming's brain at the quantum level, so they couldn't master the essence of human thought. To achieve the level of complexity and intricacy characteristic of true human cognition, they had to rely on a genuine human brain. After three generations of experimental cloud computing, the Tricelerins had to admit that simulation was no answer. They settled on the last choice available to them. Wake Yun Tianming from his endless dreams, and by coercion or inducement, make him serve Tricelaris. Yun Tianming paused in his story. Aye stared at him, her face tense.
And did you agree?
She held her breath, afraid that his answer would dash her hopes. Tianming shook his head, but Aye wasn't completely relieved. She had guessed the answer. He had at first refused, but after a regimen of non-stop inventive torture, in the end he gave in. She knew that there was a limit to the suffering a mind could endure, and she wasn't so naive as to despise him for it. Still, deep in her heart, she found it hard to accept that the man she loved was responsible for the destruction of humanity. She did not want to hear any more.
"I'm cold," she said, shivering and hugging herself. "Why don't we return to the spaceship?"
The sun had already set, and the eerie starlight of the Black Domain lit up the heavens. The temperature dropped precipitously, and AA hadn't a stitch of clothing on. Not too long ago, they had welcomed summer on Planet Blue. Their initial judgment of the climate on the planet had been slightly off. Due to the extreme eccentricity of the orbit, the planet's coldest season left almost two-thirds of its surface in a condition akin to Antarctica on Earth. But during the hottest season, parts of the planet reached 50 degrees Celsius. As the heat was simply too much to bear, the two decided to discard their clothing and live in a pre-lapsarian manner. But seasons on Planet Blue